Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the July 28th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Support for Takes on the World comes from our members and from the Anderson Valley Community Action Coalition. Now that it's summer, teens have more time on their hands. Invite them to join you in enjoying vigorous outdoor activities like hiking, water sports, rock climbing, and camping. Family time encourages communication and connection. More information is at avcommunityaction.org. For the better part of the past 3 months, North American and particularly residents of the Gulf states have been preoccupied with a leak from an oil well a mile beneath the surface, which has released hundreds of billions of gallons of the raw pollutant into what was once one of the planet's richest sources of sea and bird life, and is unlikely ever to be again. When we think of other events with which to compare, we bring up the Exxon Valdez and, of course, Katrina. Others point to a catastrophic oil leak off the Bay of Campeche in Mexico in June 1979, which was not capped until 10 months later after spewing between 10,000 and 30,000 barrels a day into the bay. But there are other horrible examples of oil pollution that have been going on for years far from the United States and rarely reported in our media. In two of them, the Niger Delta and the Ecuadorian Amazon, where the land and the rivers have been polluted by major international oil companies, the people have been living and dying with the equivalent of the current Gulf leak for years. Those are the people, and what big oil has done to them is what we're going to be talking about this morning at about 20 minutes past the hour with investigative journalist Ellen Quintero. In the meantime, let's look at some other news ignored, distorted, or underreported since we last met. I cannot, of course, compete with the marvelous Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, who you've heard this morning on Democracy Now!, who's thrown a 92,000-page monkey wrench into the war-making gears of President Obama and his generals, even as the president appoints as the head of CENTCOM a general by the name of James Mattis, who has publicly declared his pleasure in killing Afghanis he considers bad guys, namely the Taliban, to a room full of cheering Marines. He did that in 2005. It was recorded by CNN. That time, Mattis said, quote, "Actually, it's quite fun to fight them, you know. It's a hell of a hoot. It's fun to shoot some people. I'll be right up there with you. I like brawling. You go into Afghanistan, you've got guys who slap women around for 5 years because they didn't wear a veil. You know, guys like that ain't got no manhood left anyway. So it's a hell of a lot of fun to shoot them." End quote. Treating women with respect has never been an area in which the Marines have enjoyed a great reputation. But that's not all. Speaking back in 2001, Mattis, described by Defense Secretary Gates as, quote, one of our military's outstanding combat leaders and strategic thinkers, end quote, boasted that, quote, the Marines have landed and now we own a piece of Afghanistan, end quote, which in the opinion of veteran British military commentator Brian Clawfley, quote, was one of the most stupid comments ever made by a general in recent years, end quote. CENTCOM, short for Central Command, oversees U.S. operations in 20 countries and stretches from Egypt across the Middle East and into South and Central Asia. Mattis has reportedly apologized for his 2005 remarks and promised not to repeat them, but he has been appointed to such a key post by President Obama that sends a strange message to the people of Afghanistan and the entire region. That Obama did so as the military situation on the ground in Afghanistan has been deteriorating by the moment would seem to make this yet another inexplicable, indefensible exercise of bad judgment. Even the members of Congress from his own party have apparently lost confidence in his decisions as a war president. As you heard this morning, the Congress passed a $60 billion war funding bill yesterday by a 308-114 vote. But the president had to rely on Republicans to help produce a majority. The appropriation already approved by the Senate was supported by 148 Democrats and 160 Republicans. 102 Democrats and 12 Republicans voted against it, including the entire Northern California delegation, among them Mike Thompson. The vote amounted to a surrender by House Democrats in their bid to attach $10 billion in aid to state governments to prevent thousands of future layoffs, making it clear what the majority of Congress considers to be its priorities. There was another apology, this one yesterday, which received far more publicity than did General Mattis's comments. It was from award-winning filmmaker and Vietnam veteran Oliver Stone, who was forced to back down from statements that he had made to an interviewer for the Sunday Times of London that brought down the wrath of the American Jewish establishment and threatened to put in jeopardy his future in Hollywood. In an interview with the paper's Camilla Long, promoting his documentary film, South of the Border, on Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez, Stone reportedly said that it was, quote, Jewish domination of the media, end quote, that kept the Nazi leader as an isolated villain, noting that in point of fact that there were other forces that should be apportioned a lot more of the blame for World War II deaths. Quote, Hitler was a Frankenstein, but there were also a Dr. Frankenstein, said Stone. German industrialists, the Americans and the British, he had a lot of support, end quote. I should add, he had Prescott Bush, George Bush Jr. and George H.W. Bush's father, Prescott Bush. Anyway, Stone went on to suggest that the power of pro-Israel lobby AIPAC was the reason why foreign policy coverage looked the way it did. They stay on top of everything, he said. The most powerful lobby in Washington. Israel has United States foreign policy for years. Jewish groups quickly condemned the director, the LA Times reported, proving Stone right about staying on top of every comment. The Anti-Defamation League's Abraham Foxman, whose organization I successfully sued for spying on me and 10,000 others 20 years ago, suggested that Stone's comments, quote, conjure up some of the most stereotypical and conspiratorial notions of undue Jewish power and influence, end quote. And on Monday, the paper noted Stone went into apology mode. He said, quote, in trying to make a broader historical point about the range of atrocities the Germans committed against many people, I made a clumsy association about the Holocaust, for which I am sorry and I regret. Jews obviously do not control media or any other industry, he said in a prepared statement. The fact that the Holocaust is still a very important, vivid, and current matter today is, in fact, a great credit to the very hard work of a broad coalition of people committed to the remembrance of this atrocity, and it was an atrocity, end quote. Stone's apology was reminiscent of that made by Marlon Brando in 1996, who broke into tears while apologizing for having made a statement to his friend Larry King on Larry King Live that attributed blame for the racist stereotypes of people of color in Hollywood films to the Jewish producers who had made those films, wondering why, as a people who had suffered from discrimination, they could do that. Marlon never had his question answered. Hollywood is run by Jews, it's owned by Jews, and they should have a greater sensitivity about the issue of people who are suffering because they've been exploited, Brando told King. King, who is Jewish, defended Brando, saying the remark was taken completely out of context. The next person to get into hot water over his choice of words may be Britain's new prime minister, the Conservative Party's David Cameron, who was recently the guest of President Obama in Washington. As you may have heard on Democracy Now!, speaking in Turkey on Monday, where he called for Turkey's admission into the European Union, a move opposed most strongly by France, Cameron praised, quote, Turkey's relationship in the region, both with Israel and with the Arab world, as being of incalculable value. But then, treading on dangerous waters, he declared that, quote, the Israeli attack on the Gaza flotilla was completely unacceptable, that the situation in Gaza has to change. Humanitarian goods and people must flow in both directions, end quote. And finally, and that Gaza cannot and must not be allowed to remain a prison camp, end quote. Can one imagine the reaction if President Obama described Gaza as a prison camp? Well, Oliver Stone could tell him. The United Nations Human Rights Council is moving ahead with an investigation of a deadly flotilla incident off the coast of the Gaza Strip in late May, despite Israel's refusal to cooperate with it. Israel, backed by the Obama administration, has rejected a decision by the UN to have its Human Rights Council investigate the raid in which Israeli commandos stormed the ships in international waters as they tried to break Israel's blockade of Gaza. 8 Turkish passengers and 1 Turkish-American were killed in the attack. the Turkish American seems to have been forgotten by our president and members of Congress, who don't mention the incident at all or his death. All the cameras and recording equipment of the passengers of the six ships, including those belonging to journalists, were stolen by the invading Israeli commandos, and they have not yet been returned. Also stolen were personal credit cards of a number of the passengers, which were immediately put to use by the thieving soldiers once they were back in Israel. Turkey is demanding an apology from Israel before resuming normal relations, and I learned today that the Turkish dock workers are going to refuse to unload Turkish or Israeli ships docking in Turkish ports. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak, he's supposed to be the peacemaker in the Israeli administration, arrived in Washington Monday bearing two warnings for American policymakers. Sanctions won't thwart Iran's push for nuclear weapons, and Israel will strike directly at Lebanese government institutions if Hezbollah launches rockets at Israeli towns. In an interview with the Washington Post in his office on Friday, on Iran, Barak said, Israel and the U.S. share the same diagnosis, that Iran is, quote, determined to reach nuclear military nuclear capability. But he acknowledged, quote, there are differences about what could be done about it, how it should be done, and what is the time frame within certain steps could be taken. It's still time for sanctions, Barak told the Post Janine Zakaria, but, quote, probably at a certain point we should realize that sanctions cannot work. Israeli officials have carefully parsed President Obama's words, hoping to find evidence that he would be willing to use military force, wrote Zakaria. For Barak, that evidence came in Obama's December speech accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, when Obama said there will be times when, quote, the use of force is not only necessary, but morally justified, end quote. That would be some legacy for Obama, that his Nobel Prize speech would be used to justify yet another immoral war by Israel, which seems to be addicted to it. Another area where Israel believes force may be necessary is Lebanon, wrote the Post Zakaria. Since the summer war with Lebanon ended 4 years ago, in which Hezbollah fought Israel to a standstill, Tel Aviv claimed that the militia, which began as a resistance force to Israel's 1982 invasion, has built an arsenal of 40,000 missiles and rockets. Barak warned that the next time violence breaks out, Israel would strike directly at the Lebanese government, which he said is allowing Hezbollah to rearm. If Hezbollah fires a rocket into Tel Aviv, Barak told Zakaria, quote, we will not run after each Hezbollah terrorist or launcher. We will see it as a legitimate to hit any target that belongs to the Lebanese state, not just to Hezbollah, end quote. Since it is unlikely that Hezbollah would initiate a war with Israel, what Barak is saying is that should Israel decide to launch an attack, any serious attempt by Hezbollah to retaliate will be met by an attack on all of Lebanon. Lebanese Prime Minister Saeed Harari has said Israel's, quote, trying to justify a war against Lebanon that it could launch when it wishes, end quote. And he has complained to the UN to no avail about Israeli surveillance flights over Lebanese territory. In 1978, again in 1982, Israel launched unprovoked attacks on Lebanon, killing tens of thousands of innocent civilians and wounding tens of thousands more. In 1978, Jimmy Carter ordered Israel to withdraw after 3 months or face an aid cutoff. But in 1982 and in 2006, Israel had the backing of two Republican presidents and virtually a united Congress, which guaranteed that Israel would pay no price, either politically or economically, for its war crimes. Congress may be even more in the pocket of Israel's American agents today than at any time in history. And as we have said, sadly, earlier this month, Obama lacks a spine to stand up to Netanyahu. Politicians are being judged not for what they plan to do for their constituents, but what they're planning to do for Israel. In Pennsylvania, where a former admiral, Joe Sestak, defeated longtime Israeli firster Arlen Specter in the Democratic primary, a new group, Emergency Committee for Israel, founded by neocon Chicken Hawk Bill Kristol, is running TV spots accusing Israel of being a friend of terrorists and not being loyal to Israel. Sestak's campaign has asked Comcast to cease running the ad. It has yet to do so. On the other side, the liberal J Street Jewish lobbying group has taken out ads defending Sestak as a loyal supporter of Israel. The Delaware County Congressman describes himself as an ardent supporter of Israel, reports the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and says no critic has cited any vote in Congress in which he has failed to support a position favorable to Israel. The neocons ad also criticizes Sestak for joining 53 other members of Congress in signing a letter, quote, accusing Israel of collective punishment for blockading Hamas in Gaza, end quote. As to comment on the ad, Pat Toomey, Sestak's Republican opponent, emphasized that its sponsors were independent of his campaign. He did, however, criticize Sestak for signing the letter questioning aspects of the Gaza blockade. The letter to the Obama administration, in fact, did not oppose the blockade, but urged that certain provisions be eased for humanitarian reasons. Sestak has said separately that he supported the blockade. And more broadly, he noted the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, he bristles at the suggestion that he is anything less than devoted to Israeli security. My guest today, Ellen Cantero, is a journalist whose work on Israel-Palestine has been published widely for 30 years in such publications as Counterpunch, Mother Jones, The Nation, Grand Street, and Village Voice, where I first read her reports from the West Bank after the 1982 invasion by Israel of Lebanon. She is now working on climate change and big oil, which have much to do with the Middle East, Israel, and Palestine, as well as the rest of the planet. According to Tom Engelhart of Tom's Dispatch, phones conversations with her daughter, stepdaughter Kim, she and her husband, who have a scuba diving business in the Florida Keys, led indirectly to the story we're going to talk about today. Welcome, Ellen Cantero, to Takes on the World.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to hear your voice after reading you for so many years.
It's nice to hear yours.
You know, for a number of years, as I just mentioned, you've been writing on issues concerning Israel and Palestine. So when I saw your byline on an excellent article on the crimes of big oil, I was pleasantly surprised. What caused you to investigate the crimes of the oil companies beyond what we see happening today in the Gulf?
Let's go back 30 years. I knew about climate change then. I had friends who were scientists who were exploring climate change. And so I was aware of climate change. But like a lot of people, I simply postponed investigating it. I thought that they would take care of it. I thought that Bill McKibben was writing well about it. I thought that there were writers far more qualified than I was. And then finally, it just got to be too much. I have increasingly become convinced that climate change, together with catastrophes like what has just befallen us in the Gulf, are really the greatest issues confronting us and our planet. And that I would, if you will, forgiving the expression, take the plunge, start ramping up my knowledge about climate change, and begin writing. And what happened was that the Deepwater Horizon collapse and the ensuing disaster took place. And as you've pointed out, I proposed to Tom Engelhart, who is the editor of Tom Dispatch, that I do a personal story focusing only on, well, fanning out from the situation of my stepdaughter and her husband, who run this marvelous educational, ecologically focused scuba diving school and tour boat in the Florida Keys. What happened was I went to Europe and I came back and personal stories had been really overcovered, and so I decided that I would take two formerly very beautiful and very pristine regions of the world, ecological treasures, and those were the Ecuadorian Amazon and the Niger Delta, and show what big oil has done to them, and make the links between these and our own Gulf catastrophe. to say to American readers that we must now consider oil, the late stage of oil civilization, as a form of global terrorism, and that it will kill us all unless we get off oil and we switch to alternative energies now. I know that that's a glib summary, and I know there's much to be said about it. But I also wanted to be very, very graphic about how I presented readers with pictures of the destruction that has taken place in the Ecuadorian Amazon and in the Niger Delta. And so I did a great deal of research, background research, reading, and online access to photographs and videos. And so the article came together.
Well, the very last line of your article says, think of oil civilization in its late stage as a form of global terrorism. Actually caught my eye because it obviously is. We, in particularly in the United States, but I'd say in Western society, but in the United States, we've become so addicted to petroleum products that even in the Gulf, where the people have seen what this oil leak, I think calling it a spill is like spilling something, this oil leak has done to the Gulf, they have become so dependent, workers there, laborers have become so dependent on working on these rigs that even as it is destroying their environment, they want to go and destroy it more and keep the drilling going on. And even you write about these judges with ties to the oil industry overruling President Obama's decision to put a moratorium on the drilling, as if a court should decide, a sitting judge should decide whether an environment can live or die.
That's right. I would you mind if, can we come back to this? It's a very important point. Your listeners will not have read my story, probably. And so could I come back to the notion of late oil civilization?
Yes.
First, and then to the notion that it is a form of global terrorism. What I mean by the phrase late oil civilization is what Michael Clare, who writes for Tom Dispatch, describes in two recent essays. The concept is simple. We have reached the point where we cannot access oil in easy places anymore. Instead, what we have to do is to go to extreme places, places so deep in the sea that drilling there is an unprecedented experiment, and disasters there an unprecedented and catastrophic experiment with the globe. So that is late, what I mean by late oil civilization. We're in an age of, quote, extreme energy. That is Michael Clare's phrase. It's not mine. And let me flashback to a moment that I describe in my article about oil exploitation of the Amazon basin part of Ecuador, making a passing note to your listeners who I'm sure are aware that the Amazon rainforest is the planet's lungs. It's often called the planet's lungs because it supplies the planet with 20% of its oxygen. And I write about the rainforest before Texaco came to this region. I chose only one region. There are many regions of the Amazon that are being exploited by oil, but I chose one. I couldn't write about all of them, this part of Ecuador, with a staggering abundance of birds, plants, animals, and foliage, with streams and tributaries winding through a humid lushness to the Amazon River, the region seemed like a blessing rather than something that could be owned by anyone. And I go on to describe the notion of common wealth, which was believed in by the indigenous peoples of this and other Amazon regions. And there is a man I quote, whom your listeners can access. If they go to my article, they will find a hyperlink to his interview. Umberto Piaguaje, he says, "The oil beneath the ground was the blood of our grandparents, our ancestors. The rainforest was a university that conferred its knowledge on those who lived there. Its medicinal plants made it the people's hospital. Its vegetables and animals made it their marketplace." And now imagine, into this pristine, unparalleled wealth, one day appears a helicopter. This is in 1967, and the same man, Umberto Piaguaje, in 1967 was 8 years old, and he said he'd never seen anything like this helicopter. He thought it was some kind of strange bird. Later, he heard strange sounds coming from the forest. And then within 6 months, the first oil spill appeared in a stream near where his family lived. After he grew up, he lost two children. An infant stopped developing after he was 6 months old, and an older child went to swim in the oil-polluted river. He swallowed some of the water. Later, he began to vomit blood, and he died the next day. And what Criollo says is, "They came and spilled oil, they contaminated the river, and my children died." In other words, a man like Umberto Piaguaje didn't ask for this to happen. It literally came from the sky. And if this is not terrorism, I don't know what is. In its first 25 years, Texaco pumped 1.5 billion barrels of oil out of this region, which is called the Oriente region. It's to the east of Ecuador. And it discharged 345 million gallons of pure crude oil into the Ecuadorian rainforest and waterways. It also dumped 18 billion gallons of toxic wastewater directly into the environment. And not only this, it had hundreds of wells, and next to these wells, it dug into the forest floor at least twice as many unlined waste pits. And it had drainage pipes that it ran from these waste pits into the stream. So intentionally, it intended to drain off this very, very toxic filth into the Ecuadorian ground water and water systems. And so what happened over the next decades is that with no other water sources, the people were gradually poisoned. And only one result, reported by a Harvard medical team and Ecuadorian health authorities, is that the region abounds in 8 sorts of cancer that result from this kind of oil contamination. There are legion birth defects in the region. There are legion skin diseases. There is a lawsuit which has been brought by 30,000 indigenous Ecuadorians and 2 lawyers, an Ecuadorian and an American lawyer, and this case is still pending. If it were favorable to the plaintiffs, it would force Texaco to pay $27 billion, which would not restore the people's way of life. That's destroyed. It would be some compensation. Then in the Niger Delta, I'm just going to read you what one of my sources, a man named Douglas Yates, who has a forthcoming book called The Scramble for African Oil. It's forthcoming from Pluto Press next year. And what he writes is, "For 50 years, oil exploitation has polluted the environment so profoundly in the Niger Delta," this is Africa, "that its large human populations can no longer survive with their traditional rural mode of production." Fishing, for example, and farming were rural modes of production before Shell BP came to the Niger Delta, and now people cannot survive from this. Flaring of gas, that means burning off the gas components of crude oil. Flaring of gas by the oil companies. This is illegal in the U.S. It's formally illegal in Nigeria, but Nigerian governments are super corrupt and simply ignore their own rulings. Has raised the temperatures around local communities to levels where people live in a kind of hell on earth. The air is hard to breathe. The water has been contaminated by oil. The fish are dead. Where once the Niger Delta could feed millions of people, fishermen must now enter into other economic activities in order to survive and feed their families. Where once crops could grow, where fruits could be picked from mangrove forests, now villagers must buy their food by selling themselves for money to the highest bidders. Before oil, the Niger Delta was a rich and fertile environment. After oil, the Niger Delta is a wasteland. And let me give you a couple of startling statistics just about the Niger Delta. There's no trickle-down effect in oil states. Typically, oil states have tiny elites that are client governments of the U.S. Usually, we are the greatest superpower on the planet still. And these elites rake in the oil wealth while the masses of the people receive little or none. So Nigeria's leaders have raked in $700 billion in national oil revenue since 1960. And that's 1% of Nigeria's population has pocketed over 75% of its energy wealth. However, the number of people subsisting on less than $1 a day grew from 36% to more than 70% over the course of 30 years between 1970 and 2000. From 19 million people who earned less than a dollar a day in 1970 to 90 million who earned less than a dollar a day in 2000. And let me just add one last figure. 40% of U.S. crude oil imports come from the Niger Delta.
Well, that's it's a sad story. I want to get back to the Niger Delta in a moment.
Yeah, pepper you with so many.
This, I'm listening to this, and I read your article. It's very, very powerful and very. It's depressing. I mean, I remember in 1993, we're talking about 17 years ago.
That's right.
That suit was filed in Ecuador. 60 Minutes called the largest environmental lawsuit in history. That 60 Minutes show was on years ago, too, wasn't it?
I can't remember, actually.
It was quite a long time ago, and then it dropped off. That we hear nothing at all about it. And here is $27 billion. Chevron, it's now Chevron Texaco, makes these huge profits every quarter. You're in the oil business, you're going to make money. And yet, we hear nothing about it.
Hear nothing about it. There are many. I have to go back to that case and find out where it is. Just before I posted my article, though, I learned that it was, quote, still pending. So there are the devil's in the details there. I don't know what that those two words mean. I don't know where the litigators are at. And, of course, typically oil companies will try to drain their opponents' coffers so that, 20 years hence, they won't have to pay anything. The case will die from financial attrition. Let's hope that doesn't happen. Well, but it's not odd that it's not in our news, because look, what else isn't in our news? We'll pop up one recent story about health consequences to Gulf oil spill workers. The most recent report I've seen on that is a Time magazine report. But I, you know, you don't have the, this is the biggest story. This is one of several of the biggest stories in the world, and our national media should be working on it 24/7, 365. The majority of our people are affected. The minority want to keep these stories hidden. So, you know, I'm not surprised that the case against Texaco is not in the foreground in the media.
Well, even among those people, the solidarity movements, the non-intervention movements, the we hear a lot of talk about the positive things that have happened in Venezuela, mm-hmm. or let's say people go down to Cuba, but when it comes, Ecuador has actually had an election of somebody who is somewhat different than the previous presidents. I'm
curious. Yeah, Rafael Correa.
Yes,
and he came in. Don't quote me because I'm a few, four years ago, and he was very promising. For progressives, he was very promising, not for the oil companies. And he sided with the litigants, the plaintiffs in the oil case, and under his administration, a new constitution was drawn up, which actually had a Nature's Bill of Rights. Very interesting to read about. Lately, he has shown signs of lining up with neoliberal economics in the form of the Ecuadorian, another extraction business, the mining business. And so his base has been very alienated from him. Sound familiar?
It sounds familiar. Now, in Nigeria, we've seen armed resistance, which has gotten in the way of the last several years. We've seen oil workers kidnapped. We've had ransoms. The people in the Ogoni land have gotten almost nothing except martyrs of people who've tried to lead them out of this morass. Maybe you could talk about something about what's going on in the Niger Delta. My guest, by the way, is Ellen Quintero. She's written a book, an article called Big Oil Makes War on Earth, The Gulf Coast Joins an Oil-Soaked Planet. You could find it on Tom Dispatch, on the, it's T-O-M Dispatch, one word, on the internet. What's happening with the armed struggle against the oil companies in the Niger Delta?
Let me go back a little bit further.
Yeah.
To the 1990s, and a pacifist movement that some of your listeners may remember, some of your older listeners.
We have older listeners, yes.
Okay, good. So they will remember that there was a Nigerian leader who became legendary named Ken Saro Wiwa. He was a nonviolent activist, and he told an audience of his people in 1990, "We are going to demand our rights peacefully, nonviolently, and we shall win." And the movement adopted the tactics of South Africa's anti-apartheid movement, promoting divestment from Shell. It staged peaceful demonstrations. Apparently, it got Shell's notice because it got to be quite a large movement. Shell nudged the government, which then in 1995 hanged Saro Wiwa and eight other nonviolent leaders. There was a case that was brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights on behalf of Ken Saro Wiwa's son and other plaintiffs, and Shell settled out of court, thereby tacitly admitting its complicity with the murder of Saro Wiwa. The settlement was $15.5 million, which was a real drop in the bucket for this huge company. Now, what happened after that was predictable, since nonviolent resistance seemed not to have worked. More militant forms of action sprang up, and there is now a movement called the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, MEND. And it has become so disruptive and so powerful through sabotaging pipelines, kidnapping foreign oil workers. And what I say in my article is, and quote, even piracy, but I'd like to make a comment on that in a second or two. It's come close to bringing the oil industry to a standstill here. This is not my insight, but that of Michael Watts, W-A-T-T-S, whom your readers can also look up on the Internet if they are really interested in this, where they can source him through my article. He's a major writer on the Niger Delta. So Shell has shut down its major operations in the Delta, and a 2007 World Bank study showed that 36% of young people interviewed had a, quote, willingness or propensity to take up arms against the state. Now, I'd like to come back to words like theft and piracy. Some of your listeners may have read an excellent book by Peter Maas on oil, sort of blocking on the title. Maybe I can. It's not necessary to get it. His name is spelled M-A-A-S. And if you read a chapter on how oil executives and CEOs operate, the notion of a people on whose land, under whose land and under whose waters oil is, quote, discovered and then exploited by foreign oil companies or by state companies managed by elites that pocket all the wealth, the notion of piracy and theft become ludicrous because these notions depend on a reading of the world that privileges corporations and entitles them to own the planet and to exploit the planet under the only law that the bottom line rule of corporations, which is make your profit margins and hang the rest. Everything else is called an externality. This is part of corporate law. It's not a figment of my imagination. It's not a figure of speech. It's, any elementary economics student will learn this in his or her course. Externalities refer to everything else, including rainforests, including animals and plants and fish and all of life on the planet.
Is that another term for collateral damage?
Well, no, collateral damage is another term. I don't think it's a military term. But no, I mean, externality is really a corporate legal term. And once again, go to my article, click on the hyperlink, and you can learn easily about what that term means. Yeah, I mean, it sloughs off the notion, you know, any notion of emotions like reverence, compassion. I mean, these are ridiculous. These are not practical. These are externalities, you know. That's it. I don't want to go on any further about this. I think I've made my point.
Anything that could get into the way of profit.
Anything that gets in the way of profits. Now, oil, like companies, corporations do what they do. I'm not saying that they justly, in moral terms, or rightly, in moral terms, do what they do, but they are set up by the laws they're governed by, and which their operatives, their CEOs, their top managers, their workers imbibe in any management course, any elementary economics course, and And these corporate law notions are come to seem natural. They are what corporations do. Corporations are like machines, and they operate according to these laws, which have now been, of course, amplified by our recent Supreme Court decision, which expands the, quote, personhood. Corporations in the U.S. are persons. I don't believe they are such in Europe, but under U.S. law, corporations are persons, and now they have the right to free speech.
Rather large persons,
but they aren't persons. They're more like, I don't know, I might write something on this. They're more like, maybe one of your listeners would like to write something on it. They're more like robots. They're made up of people, but they simply go forward doing what they're doing unless they are stopped. They have to be stopped. The only way to stop them is through mass movements, which include lawsuits, boycotts. In the U.S., to come back to your initial point, trying to make some inroads into American opinion, which is a very tall order indeed, when we are constantly bombarded by corporate propaganda. But if it doesn't happen, we are doomed. I don't think it's overstating the case to say we really will be killed by oil. Whether it happens in two or three generations, this planet will go under. Because don't forget global warming. This is also happening. We are not just talking about oil spills in the Gulf, and apparently spill is a ridiculous word, I agree with you. We're talking about volcano, an oil volcano, an oil gusher. But this was unleashed by human agency or by corporate agency. We should not be doing deep water drilling. I'm sure many of your listeners would agree with me on that. It should stop.
Well, out here, certainly, we're, at least I'd say most of our, if not all our listeners, are against offshore drilling. It's interesting, the New York Times today has maps on the front page, a headline, "On the surface, oil spill in Gulf is vanishing fast. Few huge patches left. Some encouragement concern lingers on unseen harm." BP has been running an ad virtually every day in the New York Times for weeks since this leak occurred. And it's obviously in the interest of all the corporations, including the publishing corporations, to put the best face on this situation as if it's going to go away. This has been a fascinating, I was as fascinated by the article and fascinated by your rundown. I know there's a lot of concern in this county about...
What county are you in?
This is Mendocino.
Uh-huh.
In 2004, I believe it was, we had a 15% vote for Ralph Nader here, the highest of any county in the country.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, so people here are very concerned about the environment against GMO foods. Mm-hmm. Briefly, what do you think people can do? Would you recommend people doing who are concerned about the situation of the corporations and the oil corporations in particular?
Well,
wave your wand.
I wish I could. I'm a writer. I'm not an organizer. I myself have I'm scheduled to call my legislators today. I do this regularly. I'm not anyone special in suggesting that what we need is something like a new civil rights movement. We need a mass movement about this. And gosh, if I knew how to organize it, I suppose I wouldn't be writing so much. I would be out there. I would be out there organizing. People could get in touch with the Union of Concerned Scientists. People can get in touch with 350.org, which has in October. It's coming up with a series of work demonstrations. Last year it had some just demonstrations in which people across the globe got together en masse and formed patterns that spelled 350.
Is that number 350.org?
Yeah. It alludes to the number of parts per million of carbon dioxide, per unit of air, beyond which civilization as we have known it and life on the planet cannot exist. And we are already at, I believe, 400, if not more.
Whoa. Ellen, we're coming to the end of the hour. I want people to be able to read your article. I want maybe, Ellen, it's Cantarow. It's C-A-N-T-A-R-O-W. C-A-N-T-A-R-W. Ellen, just Google Ellen. Just Google your name, and this article will come up. And just the big oil makes war on the earth. And you'll find this article. That's correct. Also, go to Tom Dispatch, one word. Anything else? Any final last word? This has been a depressing but hour, but a very important hour.
You know, we didn't believe during the Cold War that anything would happen to break the Cold War. And then the Civil Rights Movement came into being. I think progressives are quite depressed, you know, and I'm no exception. But we have to believe that we can do something. We have free will. We can get together with our neighbors. I think work on the local level, by the way, is extremely important. Extremely important. It can't be underestimated.
On that note, I agree with you completely. I want to thank you very much, Ellen Cantarow, for being our guest today and bringing this information on what the oil companies have been doing to us. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey,
for being my guest.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Ellen Cantarow. As I say, you could find her work online. Very interesting, depressing program. Next Wednesday, Joy LeClaire, now based in Boulder, Colorado, will be speaking with sleep disorder specialist Dr. Matthew Edlund about his new book, The Power of Rest. We all need to get more, but we also have to be active. This is Jeff Blankford. I want to thank you very much for being listening to Takes on the World today. I'll be back with you on the 11th of August. You've been listening to Takes on the World on KZYX 90.7 FM, Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Williston, Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio, also streaming on the web at kzyx.org.